No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and join in a discussion by calling 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype your questions in at BBSRADIONE. We have a special guest tonight to talk about statehood, Doug Smith. Doug is a longtime statehood advocate, and we want to get his take on what's been going on lately in the District of Columbia. And that's going to be the first half of the show. And then after we talk to Doug for a while, Maria and I are going to discuss the latest news. Maria is not with us for the first half of the show today. Doug, are you there? Doug Smith?
Yes, okay. Yes, I'm here.
How are you? First of all, let's start there. Okay.
I'm doing fine.
Good.
I'm doing
So, Doug, tell me what you think about what's going on right now with statehood. The idea that the mayor has put forth this advisory referendum on the ballot in November, and we're trying to get people to agree to support statehood. What do you think of all this?
Well, I think that the mayor took a bold step forward in attempting to do this. As a former commissioner here in Washington, D.C., I guess I was on one of her short list as a person to invite to participate. And being a member of several groups over the years, like the Friends of 51st State, D.C. Statehood Coalition, and Free D.C., I think what the mayor did was helpful. I hope that it's inclusive of all of these groups that have been active in statehood, the quest for statehood down the years. Will be involved in, making this thing finally come to pass.
Well, first, let me tell you, Doug, that you're always on my short list. And I think that people like you that have been involved for years have to, we really need to reach out to them. And I think this has been, just to be honest with you, one of the problems that we've seen so far with this plan is that we didn't reach out to enough people. And people
right.
are mad about that. And you probably know that last week we had a hearing in front of the city council on the 27th. And again, we're going to have a hearing on the 6th of October. And this is to discuss the new constitution that was written basically by the new Columbia Statehood Commission, which is me, the other shadow senator, Paul Strauss, Representative Garcia, the mayor, and Phil Mendelson. There's a lot of people that are upset with that constitution. And I think the thing you're most upset about is that they feel like they weren't included. Do you feel that way?
One of the earlier meetings that I attended was on the campus of Gallaudet University.
Yes,
and
I remember.
A lot of people stood up and voiced their, concern about not being included in that process. I'm concerned about that. I believe in inclusion and transparency and everybody having a part in it, especially the stakeholders, which are the citizens of D.C. But I'm more concerned about being, as you said in the introduction, the last colony. And if the Constitution that you guys wrote is more, if that's a more reasonable approach and it's more likely to pass the hurdle that it has to pass, and that's Congress, I'm able and willing to go along with it, knowing that it might be an arduous task later on to change things that are not really beneficial to this community, to our state. Then those things can be addressed at that time. But statehood right now is my main issue.
Well, you know, that's the message that I'm trying to get across, exactly what you just said. The Constitution may not be perfect. These are things that can be addressed after the fact. But the important thing is that we vote yes on statehood. I mean, once we become a state, we can adjust things, and you're absolutely right. Tennessee actually wrote their constitution three different times after they became a state. So those things can be addressed. But and that's been really the fly in the ointment, so to speak, or the rub here, is that we're saying to people, look, you can be disappointed, you can express those feelings, come to the hearings the council's having, whatever, but in the end we all have to sign off on statehood. That's the important thing here, is to say yes to statehood.
I would promote saying yes to statehood to anyone, and for just what we're saying here, that this nothing is perfect, but I wouldn't want to be like stuck at an impasse just because I felt sort of slighted or that the document isn't perfect, because it's nothing is perfect. Let's say that it's a work in progress. I mean, we've been chasing statehood for how many years now? So I think we can also chase the more perfect state, as we also seek to have a more perfect union. And those are things that can be addressed later.
Well, that's right. And, you know, several people have pointed out that even with the United States Constitution, the United States Constitution was drawn up, there was no Bill of Rights. And there were several states that were reluctant to sign, just like we have now, with individuals being reluctant to get on board. There were states that said they wouldn't sign without a Bill of Rights. And the framers guaranteed them, Jefferson and Madison, I believe, guaranteed them that they would write a Bill of Rights as soon as the Constitution was ratified, and sure enough, they did. The Bill of Madison sat down and wrote the first 10, you know, they wrote the first 10 amendments to the Constitution almost immediately. So, yeah, all these documents need to be, you know, all these things need to be adjusted as the state comes into being. We've never been a state, so we're not even sure about certain things once we become a state, I think. I think that there are things that will manifest themselves that will have to be dealt with. For example, we dealt with this Constitution. We dealt with an attorney general, which is an elected office now in the District of Columbia, but was not an elected office when the Constitution was originally modified in 1987. Right. So I think you're absolutely right. What about the fact that we don't put any money into this? This is a big complaint that I have, Doug. What do you think about that? You know, that just to give you an example, we have this streetcar line that goes 2 miles, and we pay $200 million for it, and nobody's riding it, as you know, right? Nobody's riding it. So they just decided a couple weeks ago they're going to put $2 million into promoting the idea of people riding the streetcar line, right? Because they've already spent $200 million for it. But as far as statehood goes, they're going to put $200,000 into promoting statehood. And I think that's just ridiculous. I think we need to put, you know, 10 times that money. We just had a thing with Ralph Nader that you may have seen that was at Constitution Hall, where he talked about statehood. And Nader says we need $10 million to do a nationwide campaign. And I agree with him. I think we do need $10 million to do a nationwide campaign. What do you think?
Well, I think we need to do a nationwide campaign. I think that under previous administrations, I'm not quite sure if it was Gray or Fenty. I'm not sure who it was, but there was a group that was sent out across the nation to promote and to, you know, just advocate for statehood with the various state houses. I don't know what budget they had. $10 million in today's money does not seem like it's an unreasonable amount of money that should be dedicated to promoting statehood here in D.C. So I think that yeah, we should put more money into our efforts to become a state.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. And there was a guy named Ray Brown who was the representative, as you know, for many years, and he went around the country getting resolutions passed by state legislatures. But he spent his own money to do that, just like we did when we started. With the $200,000 we're getting now to run our offices, we only got started getting last year. For the first 8 years I had this job, anything I did, I paid for. And, I mean, wow. It was just crazy. It was crazy. I put up billboards, and you know, put up billboards in Charlotte when the Democrats took the statehood out of their platform. We erected two big billboards outside the convention hall. We did all sorts of things, but the biggest problem with that is that you can you stop and you start. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You collect enough money to do the billboards, and then when you should follow up and do something else to build upon any momentum that you've gained, you can't do it because you don't have the money anymore.
That's right. Well, I know that with the Friends of the 51st State organization, that are you familiar with them?
No, I'm not, Doug. Tell me about them.
Kashini Ladwetti and Jesse Lovell and that group.
Oh, yeah, yeah. DC for Democracy. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yes, DC State Coalition, Friends of First Lady. Yeah, we started an effort, and I was working with them, and they called on me to work with them, where we were trying to reach out to family members and friends who lived in different states and establish committees and groups that were, you know, friends, our personal friends and our personal family, to see if we could galvanize some kind of support around the country that way. And there was some reasonable support given, but that's just so grassroots that it's just hard. Like you said, there's a lot of stopping and starting because it's just really an ad hoc kind of way of doing things. I think the more money we put into this, now that the mayor has convened this group led by guys like you and others, Garcia, that we do need to be funded and well-funded so that we can show people around the country that we are serious about this effort to become the 51st state of the United States of America.
Right, and I think, you know, again, I agree with you, and I think that's very important. I often hear people like Mark Plotkin, who you know, criticize the president, for example. He'll criticize President Obama, who has actually said he's for D.C. statehood, but he'll say he's not doing enough. And I always say to Mark, look, we have a rally in front of the White House, and we're 670,000 people who've been denied our rights, and 200 people show up for the rally. And other 200 people, I know 150 of them, because they're the people that show up for every right? You would know them, too. They're the people that, like the people you just mentioned. They're the people that show up for everything. And I say to Mark, look, if I was the president's advisor, I would say don't get involved in this fight, Mr. President. It only affects the people of Washington, D.C., and they don't care enough about it to even come out to the rally. So I think, you know, that's the other half of the coin. I think that we have a serious problem that's going to take money to get the word out across America, because we can't bestow statehood upon ourselves. We need Congress to do it, and we need to put pressure on congressmen in local districts. But we also have an education problem inside the District of Columbia and to get people out. You know, I kind of feel – I don't know how you feel about this, but I kind of feel like if tomorrow they took the voting rights away from the people of Michigan, people in D.C. would be on the street screaming about it.
Yeah.
But when it comes to us, you know, I say growing up, I had a friend whose father was a child psychologist. His kids were the worst kids in the neighborhood, you know, because he was all
he's out fixing everybody else's kids. His kids were the kids that were always getting into trouble, you know. And that's kind of the way I feel about D.C. sometimes. Like, you know, we're willing to get involved in any social movement. We're very socially progressive here. But when it comes to taking care of ourselves, we're like, eh. You know, and I really don't get that. And let me tell you, your effort to reach out to people outside the district makes so much sense, because there's so many of us here that have family and friends outside the district, and so many people that have moved through the district because they were stationed here temporarily with the military or the government or something else. So a lot of people that love this city that don't live in the city. So let me ask you this question. This is another concern that we have, or that I have, and that is that the ballot question is somewhat complicated. It asks you four things that are required of the Constitution to become a state. Do you want to be a state? Do you accept the Constitution that's been drawn? Do you accept the boundaries that have been set up for the new state? And will you have a representative form of government? It actually says a Republican form of government, and they changed that to representative because they're afraid of the implication of putting in the District of Columbia. We don't use the R word very often. We're pretty, you know, where there's only 16 Republicans in the whole district, and we know where they are. We keep track of them. But anyway, how do you think people are going to feel when they go to the polls and they see these four questions? I'm not sure we've adequately explained to people what this means. And it works. What do you say?
Well, Senator, let me say this, Senator, first of all, to your previous statements about people not seeming to show interest. At my church, which is New Bethel Baptist Church at 9th and S Street, Northwest Washington, D.C., where the pastor is Reverend Dexter Udell Nuttall, he's tasked me with several things that engage the community. And one of the things we want to do is to stage a forum. I know there have been forums all across the city, but there need to be more because of the lack of interest or the lack of knowledge about this statehood issue. And, you know, the particulars about statehood. So we're going to do that, and I'm hoping that I can lean on you to help us put this together quickly this month so that we might have impact on the vote that's coming up, that we might have impact on people coming out to show that we have a concerned and informed electorate. I think that's even that's important almost to the level of statehood, that people get out and vote and be informed about the issues before them. Now, these questions that are going to be on the ballot, it is concerning because sometimes people just are not informed, and if they're not informed, they won't address the issue. It's like you said, the statement about a Republican. A lot of people say the United States is a democracy, but the United States is really a republic. So that term, to someone who knows that, wouldn't be frightening or offensive. And so the Bible says that we suffer for lack of knowledge. So I think the forum that we're going to put on, and I hope you help me with that, you have committed to it, that we get out and inform people and excite people and ignite people into this coming election to vote yes for this Constitution, for vote yes for statehood and yes on the Constitution, and to inform them about these questions. And if there's a chance, I don't know what, at this late date, if that can be changed, if they're so onerous that they shouldn't even be on the ballot. I think that you kind of making that inference that they shouldn't even be on the ballot, and maybe that's something that should be changed. But informing
them. I don't think it shouldn't be on the ballot because they're part of the Tennessee plan to make the demand. And that's really the idea here, is that we're going to go to Congress and a new president and say, look, we're ready. The people have spoken. They want this. They agree to all these things, and we're ready to roll. So I don't think it shouldn't be on the ballot. And another thing I just want to point out is, yes, I've committed to do this, and it's just a matter of scheduling. But, yes, we'll make sure that it happens, because not only do we have to inform these people, but I got to tell you, another piece of the puzzle for me is the church. When you look at the civil movement in this country. And I don't care if you go back to when women got the vote or when African Americans pressed for their civil rights or gay people pushed for their rights or, you know, whatever the issue is, the church has always been very involved in the movement, and the church isn't so much involved in our movement. Although, you know, we talk at churches in the district, and there are many reverends, not all, maybe one of them, that is sympathetic to our cause. But unfortunately, we haven't involved the church enough, and that bothers me. So I want to do it not only to get out there and talk to people, but I want to do it because it's a church, and I think churches are important to us and important to our movement. You know, Thomas Jefferson, you quoted the Bible. Thomas Jefferson said that resistance to tyranny is obedience to God. And I keep on thinking about that. Yes, we need to be obedient to God. This is tyranny. Yeah, I'm anxious to do that. Well, we're running out of time here, Doug, but I'd like to give you a couple of minutes. Any last thoughts from you about any of this?
Well, yeah, just let me say this, because I am going to speak to these issues from a faith-based perspective, and I'll just say that maybe as the senator of our great city, soon-to-be state here, you might address the head of the mayor's Office on Religious Affairs to try to excite and ignite the churches in D.C., and I would like to work with you on that if you decide to go that route. But also, I'd just like to tell anyone who's listening, who will listen to someone who's coming from a faith-based perspective, that what you said about churches and God is true, and what Thomas Jefferson said, I think, reflects the scripture Micah 6:8, which asks, what would God have us do? What does God want us to do in cases of injustice and any matter? And the scripture is quite plain, and I'll try to say it quickly. God demands that we seek justice, that we love mercy, and that we walk obediently before our God. So I think that there's nothing any more plain in the Bible than that what we are doing here and what we seek when we are seeking statehood is justice. And everybody deserves to have justice in this great country that we have here. And the citizens of Washington, D.C. are suffering under what you described, alluding to Thomas Jefferson, as tyranny, because we do not have representation in the halls of Congress. I mean, that's my final statement. Mike, you know, that's the way I feel about it.
Well, and I got to agree with you again, Doug, and you truly are preaching to the choir when you're talking to me this way, because I was a youth group leader in my church, and I have a very, very strong faith, and I believe exactly the way you do. I believe with you. I believe Micah. I believe Amos, who said, you know, let justice run down like water and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. That was Dr. King's favorite quote from the Old Testament.
That's
basically what Amos is saying. You know, go pray to God, go worship. But if you want to know what God wants, if you want to make God happy, you will work for justice and you will for righteousness. And thank you so much, Doug Smith, for being on our show. And I look forward to working with you. And I will. Please, we'll get in touch. We'll take it up with our staff meeting tomorrow morning to get in touch with the mayor's office about reaching out to religious groups across the city, because we've got every denomination here, and Washingtonians, among other things, are very faithful people, very much children of God, I believe.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you so much for being with us, Doug Smith. We're going to take a momentary break, and then Maria and I will be back to talk about everything that's going on in the political world these days. Thanks, Doug. We'll talk again soon. And we're back with Maria Sanchez to talk about what's gone on this week. And oh my God, what a week. Maria, are you there?
I'm here, Michael. Thank you. And
thanks for
that great conversation with statehood.
Yeah, well, you know, we're pushing hard. We've only got a few weeks. It's amazing to think, but here in the District of Columbia, we're only like 20 days away from early voting.
Yeah, and then there's early voting already that started in Ohio, I guess, this week, too.
Oh, is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's getting earlier and earlier. Soon we'll be voting in July or something. I don't know. It's crazy. And I can tell you, as a candidate, that's really tough because you got to cover all those places, right?
Right.
We used to have a ground game and we put it together to get everybody to go out to the polls and push for us on November 8th. But now, you know, you've got to have in the District of Columbia, we have 8 locations, early voting locations, besides one that starts really early. So you've got to have all those places covered for 2 weeks.
Well, that's exhausting, don't you think?
Yeah, it really is, and it's tough. Last time we did it, I'm very proud of my campaign. We did very well in a citywide campaign where we used unemployed homeless people, and they were, or people that were in shelters, and they were great. We interviewed all of them. You know, you can't use all of them, obviously. But, you know, we pick and choose the very best people who were well-motivated, and they went out to the polls, and they did a great job for us, and they made money doing it. We paid them $15 an hour.
Wow.
To help us. Yeah, because we thought, you know, that's what we push them for in a minimum wage. So we tried to walk the walk and not just talk the talk. So they made some money, and it was a win-win, and they did a really great job for us.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you for that.
Yeah, and we had an election night party that was fun because lots of them came to the election night party because that's when the people that worked on election day, that's when we paid them. And so it was great. They came and they got free food and the people in upper Northwest Washington got to see how the other half lived too. So it was good. We had a great effort. And I got to give a shout out to my assistant, Rachel Bernard, because she was the one that put it together. But let's talk about this week. Okay, Maria?
First of all, we've got the vice presidential debate on Tuesday, October 4th at Longwood University in Virginia. And I feel so much empathy for the candidates because it's 9:00 your time. I mean, I understand why they do it, and I appreciate the accommodation for us on the West Coast. But darn, to have to wait all day to do that, I mean, that must be exhausting.
Well, and I think, you know, I don't think you're going to see anything nearly as dramatic as presidential debates, because both of these guys are pros. They're very much alike, I think.
I do, too.
In terms of who they are as people, I mean, obviously they have different positions on things, but I think that, you know, they were both picked for much of the same reason, to bring some stability to the ticket. And they're both accomplished politicians. And I don't think, you know, I think Tim Kaine's a very nice guy. I don't know Mike Pence, but I think that, you know, I've met Kaine a few times. I think they'll both do a reasonable job, and they really won't change opinions that much.
Agree with you. And they're, like you said, they're white males, seasoned politicians in their 50s. Probably the primary difference between them is their party affiliation, really.
Right.
And so it's probably not going to be very well watched, which is fine. And I'm glad that they're doing it. So that's on the front burner. And then back to what happened this week on Monday with the presidential debate, which, by the way, they said Nielsen reported 84 million viewers, which is the most watched ever since they began televising them in 1960. And that didn't include internet or mobile devices.
Well, so let me point out, though, still not as many as the Super Bowl. What was the Super Bowl? I think it was 110. So they're getting up there. But,
yes.
You know, I mean, I'm not sure
still,
what that
says
about us.
Still, for a political thing, though, I'm happy for that people were caring.
Yeah,
right?
Me too.
And speaking of, I thought Trump did well in the first 30 minutes, and then I think he kept taking the bait, and I have to say I thought that Hillary did really well. I hated her closing statement, though. I thought that was low, and she didn't need to go there.
Tell me what refresh
she was
my memory.
Talking about how he's a misogynist and the Miss Universe thing that happened 20 years ago, calling her Miss Piggy, and she just went down. And I looked at him as he was thinking as whether or not he was going to join her in the gutter, and I'm really glad that he didn't. But that's all he's been talking about this week now, is if he's going to start talking about Bill Clinton's, you know, sexual proclivities, if you will.
Well, look, this annoys me more than anything. First of all, I'm not sure that that's a good strategy for him, because I don't think there are many women out there that want to take responsibilities for their husbands or their boyfriends' infidelities. And I think that he makes a big mistake if he goes there, which he's already done. He's already done that. Because I don't think women want to be held responsible. And I think they will say to themselves, you know what? She didn't do anything. She didn't sleep with Monica Lewinsky. She didn't, you know, why should she be judged in any sense for what her husband did? I mean, do you feel differently? You think this is fair game?
I don't, but I don't know, I only know what I read. It's not what he did, it's what she did after the fact to the women that were guilty of the assignation. That's where I find it. She took out a vendetta on them. And there's reports of, I forget who it was, if it was Jennifer Flowers or it was some other gal who's 70-something who claims that he raped her. And she said that Hillary made a point to come to her with a smile on her face and her steely eyes and telling her basically, we know about you and we assume you're going to be quiet about this and or else kind of threat sort of thing.
I don't think standing up for your husband, first of all, is a bad thing. And I don't think there are many women, if there's a woman out there, maybe she can call in, that who likes the woman that her husband slept with. I don't think that there are any women out there who are saying, you know what, the women that were unfaithful with my husband, if that's the case, you know, I should be nice to them. I think it's a normal reaction that she had. And I would say that also, as you said, you only know what you read. You don't know what actually happened. I mean, there are plenty of suggestions that Donald Trump himself was unfaithful, and that was the rumor, that he was unfaithful to his first wife, Ivana, and
right.
That was part of their divorce.
His gossip.
I wouldn't say that about him, because it's never been proven. And this week, he suggested that Hillary Clinton was unfaithful to Bill Clinton in a debate. And that's terrible. Nobody has ever suggested that. He's really, you know, you say you don't like the fact that she went down in the gutter, but this is where this guy lives. He lives in the gutter. And he says at a personal appearance that Hillary Clinton, was probably unfaithful in his opinion. And why shouldn't she be? That's a terrible comment for which is totally unfounded as far as I can see. Nobody's ever made that claim about her. Where does he come off doing that?
Well, as you said, he needs to shut his mouth and stay on track and stop deviating, because he really is. If he continues that way, that is not presidential behavior. And that, it, you know, if you're going to swing that low,
I think he's toast. I got to tell you, I think there's that he's hit those 42% of people that will support him no matter what he says, but he's not going to get beyond that. I don't think he's ever going to get beyond that 42% of people that are angry with America and want to see a change, and so they're not supporting Hillary. They're gonna support him at any cost. But what he really, I think this was a terrible failure for him this week, because what he really needs to do is he needs to get that other 9 or 10 or 11% of the people that are undecided, and mm-hmm. I don't think the stuff he's doing is gonna get him there.
Well, the good news is this is gonna come to an end finally. at some point. If we can get back to running the business of our country. One of the stories that's making the rounds is about how many endorsements Hillary has gotten and if that's going to matter much. And of course, there's the normal ones like the New York Times. And then there's ones like on Friday, USA Today ended its tradition of not taking sides and published an anti-endorsement about Trump. And the quote is, lacks the temperament, knowledge, steadiness, and honesty that America needs from its presidents. But closer to my home, the San Diego Union-Tribune, which my folks subscribe to and read every morning from cover to cover, they endorsed Clinton, and that's the first Democrat that they've endorsed in the history of their publication. So,
well, in Arizona, you have papers too, which, you know, I think of my good liberal friend Kathleen Gomez, who's gone over to the dark side and is a Trump supporter, but she's from Arizona. And yeah, you have papers in Arizona, the bastion of conservatism in recent years.
Well, it's not only the Arizona Republic, but the Dallas Morning News and the Cincinnati Inquirer.
Cincinnati. Yes. And these are the people that he needs to win over. So I think, you know, it's been a really bad week for him, and we'll see. But I agree. One thing I do agree with you on, Maria, is that I hope that Hillary Clinton will try to stay above board, and because I don't think they both need to get down there. I think the comment that she made about his supporters was a mistake on her part, and I heard her campaign manager on Meet the Press this morning say the same thing. Well, many of his supporters are despicable. Well, that's really, you know, we're not in the business of judging voters. That's not what we should be in the business of as politicians. You and I, as radio talk show hosts, can judge them, but politicians shouldn't be out there judging voters. They should be listening to voters. That's a really important thing. And you know, regardless of how you feel about the people that are supporting Trump, and I'm speaking, when I say you, I mean liberals in general, out here, we should be trying to figure out the message that they're sending us. And the message that the Trump people are sending us is they're not happy with what's going on in America these days. And we need to listen to that.
So we have next Sunday, October 9th, the second presidential debate. And then the following week on Wednesday, October 19th, will be the third and final. And I do think one that Trump needs to prepare better slash more.
Yeah, absolutely. That was so obvious. Yeah.
And two, along what you just said, if Hillary just continues to take the high road, she's only going to look more stellar because he's when somebody's tripping over their own words, you don't need to get in the way. Just let them fall, you know, and just keep to the point, keep to the policy, keep to your recommendations, keep to your aspirations, keep to your goals, and keep your eye on the high road. She has nothing to lose by doing that and everything to lose by getting dirty.
Well, and you know what? I keep on thinking, Maria, of this thing that I learned when I first got into politics. Somebody told me, never shoot a man who's trying to commit suicide. Don't get involved. You know, if the person is imploding, then leave them alone and let them do it. I think of the Dean, Howard Dean, you know, and how he had the meltdown. And that's what we, you know, that's what we said at that time. I was involved in some of those campaigns and we said, just stand back. Don't get involved. Don't try to help him. Just stand back and let him do whatever he's doing. So I agree with that. But since you brought up the New York Times, what about the tax returns? I mean, you know, they're reporting now that he didn't, it looks like he hadn't paid taxes for 18 years.
And I can't speak to the speculation. I just was wondering prior to our talking, what is holding him back from releasing them?
Yeah, I think that's a big question for people.
It's forget the audit because we've already ascertained that that's immaterial. But what doesn't he want us to know?
Well, I think a few things, you know, but again, this is completely speculation. Mm-hmm. And I hope that he'll release his tax returns. And, you know, when he says he'll release his tax returns when she releases her private emails, mm-hmm. I just like to point out that every presidential candidate in the last 40 years has released their private tax returns, but not one of them has released their private emails. So come on, Donald, report. Let's release them. And I think what he doesn't want you to know is, first, he doesn't want you to know that he hadn't paid taxes. I think because he understands how that'll play to the people that he's trying to persuade. You know, obviously, I ran a business for 25 years. I'm just going to be honest. I never paid any more taxes than I was required to. And I didn't have lawyers that got involved, tax lawyers that got involved in this for me. I had general legal counsel. But I want to tell you, I fought every time I got the slightest fine or penalty or anything else from the IRS, I fought it with everything I had, because I figured you didn't want to set a precedent with them. You wanted to, you know, pay your fair share of taxes, but that was it. So obviously, you know, what he did was legal. It wasn't illegal, but I think he knows that it won't play well. And two, I don't think he wants to admit that he lost $1 billion in 1 year. He's supposed to be this fabulous businessman, but obviously, if you're taking a $900 million plus loss in a particular year, that doesn't look good. And it's because his three businesses that year had failed terribly: the casinos, mm-hmm. Product line that he had put out, and something else. So I think that's another thing.
I also think, though, that the average Joe, like, I was told a story about members of my extended family, and when it's got past the seven figures, my brain doesn't comprehend that. Right. Like, so was it 7 million or 1 million each? Or at that point, there's too many zeros involved, and I'm not stupid. So I think when I hear about losing $1 billion, but he's worth X billion, to me, it's like, well, that's what those big boys do, and the big girls, they play those games with all those zeros and whatever. And if at the end of the day, they're still successful, they did it right. And if they went down in flames, then obviously they did it wrong and they gambled too heavily or what have you. I don't know that that really would affect the average person, because again, I think like me, it's like, I don't know that world, Michael. I've never even been exposed to that kind of high finance, highfalutin, private jets sort of world. You probably have, so maybe you have more of an acumen.
Not unless I was the guy fueling the plane, I'll tell you that. I mean, I came from a working class background, and I can see that I ran a small business, like I say, and I understand a little bit the sentiment behind it. But no, I think the average American says, look, I pay taxes. I think you find very few Americans that would stand up and say to you, you know what, I think we also pay more taxes than we actually pay. So I don't think people particularly like taxes in that sense, but I think we all accept it. You know, my kids go to public school. They pick up my trash, although they don't do as good a job as I think they should. You know, we're protected, right? We have a military that we need to support in a dangerous world. We have local police departments and other things.
And public works,
exactly. And so I think we accept, we accept certain things. You know, as a mother, I'm sure, you know, you would agree with me on this. You know, we wish our children would do everything we absolutely tell them 100% of the time, but we know that's not going to happen, right? So we do the best we can to raise them properly, and I think that's the way we feel about taxes. We do the best we can to pay them, realizing that they're necessary, but you know, nobody loves the idea. But I don't think that people understand 18 years and not paying your taxes. I think that doesn't play well with people, even though it may be absolutely legal. So I think
we'll see. That's hanging out there is the WikiLeaks that Julian Assange has alleged that he's got more of the emails. And I'm wondering what he's waiting for, because he claims that he was going to release more. And, you know, I'm sure he's preparing it timing wise. But if people are starting to vote now and he has something that he thinks the American public should know, I would think now would be the time.
Well, you know, I got to say, when it comes to the Snowden case and pardoning Snowden, I'm a card-carrying member of the ACLU, and I agree 90% of the time with Amnesty International, but this is one place that I disagree. I think, look, you know, when you make an agreement with our government to keep top secrets secret, I think you have to stand by that. I really do. And I don't think that the information that Snowden released, I think that the American people may very well have a right to know all that stuff, given what he alleges was being done. But I don't think it was his place to release that to the public.
Well, there was a really interesting op-ed in my paper this week about what he did. One, he released it to journalists and reporters, not to the American public, so that they could parse and decide what we should and shouldn't know. Two, he didn't intend to go to Russia, but that's when his passport got revoked, so that's why he got stuck there. He was on his way to Ecuador. And three, that what he did reveal has changed the way we are, like the FBI has changed what they do, their surveillance law use. And the people now know that we're being listened to. People are paying attention to
our
conversations.
Well, that's true. I think the information he released, we may have had every right to know. But to say that he released it to journalists instead of releasing it to the public is like saying I brought three cases of beer into and left it with a bunch of 16-year-olds, but I didn't tell them to drink it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you're a journalist. You understand what they're going to do with that information. Nobody's going to say, oh, well, you know, secret information, let's not release it. I mean, it's who they are. I think of the old Russian fairy tale, you know, the old Russian fairy tale about the snake that's dying at the doorstep, and he begs the old woman to take him in, because if she doesn't take him in, he'll freeze to death. And she says, no, no, I can't take you in, you're a snake. And finally she relents and she takes him in, and the snake bites her. And she knows she's going to die. And he says to her, you knew I was a snake before you took me in. You knew I was a snake. Well, you know what journalists are going to do. You know, when I got into politics, one of my best buddies, who happens to be somebody that deals nationally with journalists for political people, said, don't ever forget that journalists are snakes and they must be handled by professionals. And I try to keep that in mind, you know, because, so he knew what he was doing when he gave up information. And that's really where I draw the line. I think that, you know, because he made an agreement not to do that, that what he did is prosecutable. But I think that the information he provided, we needed to know that stuff. I don't want people knowing, you know, listening in on all my phone conversations. I think I have a right to privacy. Go ahead.
And I guess this is when your morals come into play. And I understand that he took an oath, and I get that, and that's supposed to trump everything. But if you're learning things that are really bothering you, your conscience, what trumps – I hate to use that word since it's the last name.
Well,
in other words, when does morality step in?
Yeah, it's a tough call. And we certainly had this debate many, many times when I was in graduate school, because it was the middle of the Vietnam War. And when I was in college, because it was the middle of the Vietnam War. And, you know, that we had the same argument where we said, hey, look, we all made this tacit agreement when we were born and became American citizens to stand up as men, anyway, in those days, to stand up for our country. But when does your conscience come into play? I had nothing against the people of Southeast Asia. I had, you know, for me, it wasn't much of a choice because I decided that if I was drafted, I would go because if I didn't go, someone else would have to go and take my place. But I didn't agree with the war in Vietnam. And that was a big question. But, you know, we had a process that you could go through to become a conscientious objector. And I think that we probably could have come up with a process here as well.
But also with consequences. Look at what happened to Muhammad Ali.
So, right. And look what happened to kids that went to Canada. They lost their citizenship and spent a long time applying to come back into the country. So
because I wonder, that's where I wonder too about ethics, because as you know, ethics change over the years. Like it once was okay to beat your wife, and that's where rule of thumb came. The rod could only be as big as your thumb, and now we know that that's not okay. But ethically, back then it was accepted. Ethically, now it is not. So things change. And I'm not saying that what he did was right, but I'm saying I can understand why he did it, because morally it was bothering him.
Well, first of all, let me tell you, Maria, I married a woman from New Jersey with four brothers. So beating her was never an option for me. It was, you know, at best, I might have been able to protect myself. But, I could never. Patty Brown is way tougher than I am. Even my kids tell me that. They go, oh, Dad. You wouldn't stand a chance. So,
but I'm saying that
they do change. Yeah,
they change, and usually rightfully so, because it used to be okay to beat your children too, a pulp. You know, spare the rod and spoil the child. Right. Again, the reference to the rod. So that's why I think that Snowden does have a case that. Morally, he wasn't just doing it for publicity or to become a rock star or for personal gain. He felt that the American public should know that this is what's this big secret that we didn't know about. Now we know that there is no such thing as privacy.
Right. And I think we all can empathize with that. I refer you to something my brother said to me, my brother who's a psychologist. I said, I don't understand child abuse. I don't understand how people can abuse children. And my brother said to me at the time, that's because you don't have children. He goes, I would never abuse a child, but after you have children, you'll understand how it happens with people that are unbalanced. And you do. You go, yeah, they push me. You know, there's sometimes when I just got to go, and go up to my room, you know, and get have some daddy quiet time because you wanna do something, you know,
because you have impulse control and they don't.
Right.
That's also
and that's it. So I think we all understand what this guy Snowden did. You know what motivated him to do it, and we've all seen wrongdoing in our life that, you know, maybe we even wish that we had done something more proactive than we've done. But when we've encountered it, but yeah, I think when you make a deal like that with the government, you make a deal. Well, the conversation will go on next week, folks. I'm not sure that I'll be on the show next week. I'll be out of town. We may have to do a rerun or something. Maria and I will have to talk about that, but surely it's not over between Hillary and the Donald. No. And, or any of these other stuff. So,
In passing, not to end in a bummer, but the six-year-old who was shot in South Carolina died yesterday.
I know. It broke my heart.
You know, the poor thing, he got his femoral artery was ripped open, and that caused blood loss, which led to a major brain injury.
Right.
So, you know, you'd think getting shot in the leg wouldn't be fatal, but that's how that unfolded. So that 14-year-old who killed his dad and then now has killed a six-year-old, that man is troubled. And
and let's pray for the family of that poor little boy, and also mention, while we're mentioning this, the teacher who got shot in the shoulder but still made sure that all her kids got in the classroom and got in the building and were safe. What a hero she is. But what a terrible thing. And rather than closing the show on a bad note, let me tell you, I know that you mentioned last week about Vin Scully.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I found out yesterday, guess what his first broadcast was?
With the Brooklyn Dodgers?
No, with the it was a University of Maryland football game. I went to the University of Maryland. I happened to be watching the game yesterday, and they announced that he had done, I think it was University of Maryland played Boston College or something in 1949, and he went to Los Angeles in 1950, which is just amazing that this man spent 66 years broadcasting Dodgers.
Yeah.
So good luck in retirement, Mr. Scully, in America. We will talk to you next week.
Yes. Have a great week.
In the capital of this nation, 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.